News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, it's not all that often that I handle fiction on the morning show. We spend most of our time when we're talking with authors dealing in nonfiction. But I have no problem at all talking about a novel when it raises certain compelling questions about society and our interaction with one another. And certainly that is the case with a fantastic new novel, which is called The Haters. And it is by a best-selling novelist by the name of Robin Harding, already well known for her previous books, The Drowning Woman, The Swap, The Perfect Family, The Arrangement, The Party, and Her Pretty Face. And this particular novel, called The Haters, tells the story of one Cameron Lane, who has just had her first novel published, and it is a long-held dream finally come to reality, and it is a joyous, exciting time for her until she experiences what you might call virtual hatred. That is, someone lashes out against her and her book in really vicious fashion. And it sets in motion a whole chain of disconcerting and ultimately really terrifying events. And it is an interesting commentary on what it is like to, in a sense, be the target of hatred, of vicious attacks in this virtual realm from somebody who is faceless, nameless, and unknown, at least in most cases. And it is a really compelling story on so many different levels. And this novel is published by Grand Central, and I'm so excited to be able to speak with Robin Harding about it. Again, it is titled The Haters. And Robin Harding, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. I'm happy to be here.
Since this is our first time talking, I thought it would be interesting for us to begin by getting to know you and finding out a little bit about your own background as a writer. And maybe I should mention that I think you're speaking to me from British Columbia. So I'm assuming you're Canadian.
Yeah.
Tell us a little more about your life's journey that takes you to this point where you are now a best-selling author.
Sure. So I have been writing for a very long time. I published my first novel in 2004, and it was a really interesting time to be a published author because this was pre-social media. So it was an entirely different experience than the experience I have now and what I cover in The Haters because, you know, I was writing into a void, basically. People would say, how are people enjoying your novel? And I'm like, I don't know, probably they're liking it. Like, I was so naive. I had no idea, you know, that there could be people who might be angry about something or disliking something. And so I was publishing also very light fiction at the time, not thrillers. I was writing more like rom-coms, chick lit, we used to call it back then. And then I took a diversion into screenwriting for a while, and then I came back into literature and went directly to the dark side, published my first domestic drama, The Party, and my books just have gotten darker and darker from there.
This, yeah, interesting, and it's interesting arc. Was being a published author a long-held dream of yours, as it is for your main character? I mean, she's somebody who has another job as a guidance counselor in a school, but on the side, she is desperate to become a published novelist. And actually, by the time your novel begins, that has happened for her. I'm just curious, is there any parallel for you? I mean, were you washing dishes or digging ditches while harboring this dream on the side? Or has this been kind of the centerpiece of your professional life pretty much all along?
No, I worked in advertising for a while, and then I had two little kids, and I became a freelance copywriter. And when I should have been copywriting, I had a little bit of daycare to do this job. And when I should have been copywriting, I just do that really fast. And then I kind of wrote this sneaky novel that I managed to publish. So I totally understand my main character, Cameron's desire. Although I did have a little bit of a blessing and a curse, I guess you'd say, in that I did publish the first novel I wrote, which I know is so rare. I didn't know at the time how rare that was and how many years people invest normally trying to get published. But I say it was also a curse because I was completely delusional when I published my first novel. I thought, well, I've made it. I'm going to be a huge success, and it's all up from here. But a publishing career is not like that. It is a roller coaster of ups and downs. And, you know, one book is doing great and the next one doesn't resonate and you're back to the drawing board and then you got to rebuild. And so, yeah, that has been the realistic experience that I have had.
Right. I have to say that that's one thing that I kind of appreciated about this novel and the story of Cameron Lane, even before this misfortune befalls her, is you really give us kind of an unvarnished look at what it's like to be a published novelist. I mean, when you're not Clive Cussler or James Patterson or, yeah, you know, just name your big marquee name.
Yes.
When you are, in a sense, starting out, and there is a lot of work to do, there is a lot of anxiety mixed in with the elation of finally getting published, and especially if in the case of Cameron Lane, it's a relatively modest publishing house that's taken on the novel. I mean, it's kind of an interesting mix of emotions, with the author feeling a great degree of responsibility for whether or not this novel actually sells decently well and yeah, leads to other things. I mean, that's a reality that most of us know nothing about.
Yeah, and you know, that is a contractual obligation now for authors to promote their work on social media. So you're almost required to be, you know, engaging in that world, and it is not always pretty. I mean, in some ways, it's wonderful. I have connected with so many readers and writers, and honestly, when my books come out, I get so much support on Instagram and Facebook, etc. But then every now and then, you get somebody who doesn't like it and wants you to know it. And I mean, I sometimes think I'm too sensitive for this business, but I think most writers are sensitive people just by nature. And so we spend, 8-9 months all alone writing this book, and then suddenly we get thrust into the, you know, into the fray, and we have to perform, and we have to connect and be constantly looking at people's opinions of our work. It's really quite soul crushing at times.
We're speaking with novelist Robin Harding about her newest novel, which is titled The Haters. And this novel centers around, actually, a novelist by the name of Cameron Lane, actually a school guidance counselor who on the side has been working for many, many years to try to get a novel published. And as the novel begins, she has finally achieved that long-held dream, only to see it turn very, very dark with some unexpected criticism that comes over the internet. One of the things that is interesting about the novel, and I actually should also ask kind of about the genesis of this idea, but I first want to ask you just about the choice you make for it to begin after the novel is published. I mean, it's already a reality. And I think that's a choice that works really great. I mean, we're just kind of thrust right into the heart of the story. But another choice you could have made was to have, in a sense, kind of a longer wind-up. I'm just curious what went through your mind in terms of where and, in a sense, when to start the story.
Right. So, as I mentioned, I spent several years working on screenplays, fruitlessly mostly. I got one film produced, but I learned so much from the craft of screenwriting. And one of the adages in that business is get in late, get out early. So I always keep that in mind as far as a scene, right? Like, let's not, you know, readers don't or viewers don't want a lot of preamble. We have we want to get to know these characters and then get into the goods, especially in a thriller. So I thought there's lots of time to revisit how this was her dream as we watch it crumble. So yeah, it starts with a bang. We're at her book launch party and she's having this emotional moment, thanking her boyfriend and her best friend and surveying the room of all the people who have come out to support her. And then she gets this email accusing her of something very disturbing and, tying into her job as a high school counselor, exploiting her students in her new novel, and how fast that dream is crushed. You know, like the big high of the evening and one nasty email would just deplete you and scare you as an author.
Right.
So I thought that's like first chapter.
Hmm. And of course, you know, everyone who supports her tells her to keep this in context. And yet I think we've all kind of experienced that where in a lot of different ways, you're going to have, you know, in a sense, a whole crowd cheering for you. But all it takes is one person booing to kind of cut through it all. I'm reminded the other day when I this program on which you are a guest is also a podcast. And the other day I was looking at the ratings for the podcast version of the morning show, and there aren't a ton of ratings there, but there are some. And I'm really happy to see that they're all fives, except one person who ranked it a three. And it's funny how every time I look at that chart, my eye is just drawn to that one person who ranked it 3 out of 5 instead of 5 out of 5. And there's something about the way we're wired that is where our attention is pulled. And in the case of your novel, this Cameron Lane, she really can't think about anything else. She can't think about any of the accolades as much as she is thinking about this at the first lone voice of dissent that troubles her so much.
Yes, exactly. And they have done studies on that about, you know, the impact of, or the way we feel a negative judgment versus positive. So yeah, like your podcast, you know, could get 50 great reviews and one bad one. And that's the one you'll remember every word of it and you'll feel it so deeply. So and for her, I mean, it truly was very scary writing this novel for me because I was articulating my worst nightmare, what Cameron is going through, you know, the review bombing and people kind of jumping on the bandwagon and believing something about her that isn't necessarily true. And, you know, the internet is such a scary place, and being, you know, a public figure in any way, anyone who puts himself out there, even in a business, on the radio, with the novel, with any sort of semi-public career, you are, you know, open to such scrutiny, and anyone could just decide to destroy you.
It sounds from the way you briefly described your career that you began your career as a novelist before this virtual world had really fully taken shape. And so you began, it's 20 years ago, but in a sense, in a bit more innocent era than is now the reality for anybody who's kind of out in the public sphere. I'm curious about where you got the idea for this novel, and if to any extent it springs from anything that you yourself have directly experienced as a published author, you or maybe somebody that you know and care about who has kind of been in the crosshairs of this kind of virtual hatred.
So, I have always, for 20 years, had a website with a contact me link on it so that anyone could, you know, drop me a line if they read my book, if they had any questions. And I've noticed over the years that the messages I would get got a little bit uglier as time went on. So people used to message me, oh, that book made me laugh, or that book meant a lot, or I read it in a very difficult time in my life, and it made me feel good. Or, you know, it was usually someone who sort of, oh, I was your high school, you know, social studies teacher. I just remember it being excited when I would get messages through that link. And then, you know, in the last few years, ever since I published The Party, which is a thriller, I thought maybe it's my genre. You know, I'm writing about murder and drama and horrible things now. And people would message me to say, I loved your book until the ending, and then I hated the ending. And I'm like, well, what can I do now? Like, the book is published. I'm not sure why I need to know that. So, you know, and people would complain about various things, too much swearing, this, that, the other. And then one day I got a very abusive email sent to me by a man who had read my book, but it was kind of, I think there was some mental illness involved, because he took umbrage with one aspect of the plot, and then he just went off on me and accused me of being involved in a bunch of conspiracy theories, swearing at me. And he said to me, you look like God ironed Sarah Palin. And I was like, I know. I was like, oh, I don't even know what that means. But, you know, it was very upsetting. And I was like, you know what? I am done. I am done being so accessible. I removed that link from my website. Doesn't mean people can't get a hold of me through Facebook or Instagram or Threads, but I was like, I just felt way too vulnerable. It felt so invasive. It felt like he was in my home, and it really upset me. So I tweeted about it. I'm not on Twitter anymore, but I posted a tweet and asked other writers, you know, like, who, I just received this horrible message, and it blew up. So many writers came forward, mostly women. I feel like this is much more likely to happen to women, who had received these kind of horrible messages. And I just thought, wow, there's something really going on here. And I think I could turn this into a story.
You know, it's interesting. One of the facets of this phenomenon is the fact that sometimes we're talking about somebody who, for instance, reads your book or even just hears about your book and genuinely hates it for some reason, even if it's an irrational reason. But, I mean, they really hate it, or they really hate you, or whatever. And then we also seem to have this phenomenon, maybe kind of parallel to it, and maybe related to it, in which people engage in this for the sport of it. And it's not because they really hate your book or really hate you, but it's more that they love the idea of scaring you or creating a fuss or generating an avalanche of other comments and so on. But it isn't about any kind of real hatred at all. It's all artifice. And I wonder, you know, to what extent is that kind of a complicating factor here as well, when you're on the receiving end of something and it's in some ways maybe hard to know exactly what this means or exactly what is behind it?
Yes. So I did quite a bit of research for this book as well into the personality of someone who becomes a troll, basically, like someone who just for sport goes online and harasses, you know, people. And there's an amazing book. It's quite disturbing. It's called Troll Hunting by Ginger Gorman. She's an Australian journalist who had something heinous happen, a story she reported on the air. Could not have gone more wrong. Something very, very bad came of it. And she was completely run out of, you know, lost her job. Trolls were coming at her so hard. And she decided to reach out to them and talk to them. And it was so interesting to learn the type of people who do this sort of as almost a hobby and think that there's literally nothing wrong with it. They're usually young men who kind of have grown up in a time where they don't really think that there is a person on the other end of their hatred. And sometimes that's narcissism. Sometimes that, you know, it's I have a right to do this. Things haven't gone well for me, so therefore I have a right to tear other people down. It's a fascinating book to read. And so, yeah, when you're a writer, sometimes it's, and if someone doesn't like my book, I'm not saying everyone has to love my book by any means. There's so many places to express your opinion, like Goodreads and Amazon, and that's completely fair. And if I choose to go there and look, that's on me. What I don't like is when someone tags me in a review that they didn't like my book or emails me, because then it just hurts my feelings. The book is written. I can't change it now. And I don't see the point of telling someone directly how much you don't like what they're doing.
Right. And of course, that's part of the drama that plays out in your new novel is your main character, Cameron Lane, once she realizes that there is somebody out there with this very, very negative opinion about her book, she has to sort of figure out how to respond to that, and she ultimately responds in some ways that are not particularly helpful, but very much understandable. And I suspect that that's something that you can relate to as well in terms of your sort of visceral personal response to something like this. And then sort of intellectually what you know you should or should not do about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I have publicists and marketing people and agents and editors who would certainly, most writers know, do not engage and do not respond. But, you know, Cameron Lane, the character in my novel, is so passionate about her fledgling career, and she thinks, I can fix this, you know, I can make a difference. And so she does things that are very ill-advised. And, you know, there are stories like that too out there. There are authors who have gone after reviewers. There was someone in Scotland, I think, a male author who had a bad review, and he found the woman who wrote it and drove to where she worked. She worked at a liquor store. And he hit her over the head with a wine bottle. And there's a famous author called Kathleen Hale who published, I think she published it in the New Yorker or the New York Times. I'm not sure, like somewhere, like she wrote an article about how she went on Goodreads and found this woman who hated her book and stalked her all the way to her house. And so, you know, there's both sides of the coin, people behaving badly. And so there's, you know, that's happens in the haters. She does a lot of things that, you know, look very bad and just compound everything that's going on in her efforts to make the hate stop.
Hmm. We're talking with Robin Harding about her newest novel, which is called The Haters. It concerns a woman by the name of Cameron Lane. She is a guidance counselor in a school who has just had her first novel published at last. But what should be a very, very happy, joyous experience turns very, very dark and even quite frightening. And the novel is the story of Cameron Lane trying to come to terms with this to the best of her abilities. We haven't talked yet about, in a sense, the novel within the novel. That is, we right. get some excerpts from this novel written and published by your main character, Cameron Lane. And those excerpts are sort of set within the novel, The Haters. I'm fascinated by that construction, and I'd love to hear more about how you came up with that, how you came up with the idea of Cameron Lane's novel, and the way you kind of crafted all of this with, in a sense, two novels in one, if you will.
Yeah, so it was something new for me, which I really enjoyed doing. And most of my books are multiple points of view, and this is really a one point of view story. We're in Cameron's head and experience the whole time. So I felt like there needed to be more to the story and more kind of depth to it, or breadth to it, I guess. And I thought, I think readers really need to know, what is her novel about? Is there any truth to these claims that are being made? And so it just, the name Burnt Orchid just popped into my head. I didn't even know what the book was going to be about originally. And I just started writing it. And then I was only going to include a few excerpts. And then it kind of, that story took off as well. And it's a very dark, dark story. And I thought, you know, that kind of adds something to the novel, adds a really, you know, another layer of disturbing storyline. And, you know, it's about these very vulnerable young women. And I ended up writing more of it than I had anticipated, and interspersing it throughout the plot. And then at the end, it just worked out so organically, but I felt like the two storylines tied together in a really horrifying way. But it worked really well, and it was one of those fortuitous things as a writer when I, you know, just plucked that title out of the air, and then it became so meaningful to the way this story all comes together. I was like, oh, I like that.
That's so interesting, and certainly you're not the first novelist in the history of the world where that's happened. That the novel, in a sense, began on one path and then ultimately almost had a mind of its own, ends up going in directions that you had not anticipated at the outset. What is that like when you are the novelist and this thing you're working on, this thing you're writing, ends up not being what you initially intended? I mean, that must be kind of exciting. Is it also kind of disconcerting? I don't know.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of both. And I think, you know, at this stage of my career, I've written, I think The Haters is my 13th novel, and I'm working on a 14th. So I have enough experience to respect the story. And if something feels like a new direction is this might be better, I'll do the work to change what I've already written. You know, I'm not like, oh, I already plotted this out this way and I'm going to stick to it. If something comes that's going to make this book better, I'll go back and kill off a character early. And, you know, sometimes you have to go back and do a lot of reworking to make a new idea work. But I think I have a pretty good antenna for, you know, when a new idea comes in, to respect it. And if it is really going to make the book better, then I will use it. And I think I know sometimes, you know, I think it takes a long time, but I know, like, no, not that one. Stick with what you already knew, and or sometimes, you know, change. So you have to be, I do outline. I do kind of a rough plot outline using screenplay structure, more things I learned as a screenwriter, you know, the big story beat. But then how I get to each big story beat, I just wing it and try to make it as engaging and exciting as possible. And then sometimes a big story beat, yeah, like you said, it will change. And, you know, you have to be willing to be flexible too.
If you don't mind, I would love to read the part of the first chapter in which your title character receives this disturbing email. Would that be okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she is at this, I guess it's kind of like a launch party, and there's all kinds of important people from her life there, her college roommate, her hairdresser, most of the members of her writer's group, some local salespeople, some high school friends, and so on. So my phone vibrates in my tiny purse, a notification. It will be one of my loved ones who couldn't make it tonight, my mom or my sister on the other side of the country, or Liza, that's her daughter, stuck at her dad's place because she's too young to attend a party at a bar. Maybe it's my agent or my editor wishing me luck tonight. Martha is still talking, moving on to our meeting in the eighth grade, and I realize this introduction might be longer than my reading. I set my flute on a table and pull out my phone. It's an email sent to my author account. I'd been encouraged by my publisher to set up a website to include a contact me form. It feels fortuitous to receive my first fan mail moments before I take the stage. Eagerly, I tap to open the message. The message is from someone named Ingrid Wandry regarding Burnt Orchid. I just finished reading your book and I enjoyed it for a piece of mindless garbage. But when I read your bio that says you are a high school counselor, I was disgusted. Your novel has a prominent teen storyline, and you've obviously exploited the psyches and crises of your vulnerable public school students to make a few bucks. Shame on you. I hope their parents sue you. Humiliation burns my cheeks, makes me feel dizzy and sick. I wobble in my heels as though this woman has reached out and slapped me. Theo cups my elbow to steady me. "What's wrong?" he asks. But I can't talk. My mouth is dry and sour. I was not prepared for such hatred and vitriol. The ugliness of the words has rattled me, dredged up all my self-doubt and insecurities. "Please raise your glass," Martha says, glancing into the wings. It's my cue. "To the success of Burnt Orchid and our good friend Cameron Lane." Blindly, I stumble onto the stage. I think that is just so brilliantly crafted. I really applaud you. And one of the things that
I have to applaud you. That was a great reading.
Oh, well, thanks.
You could be an audiobook narrator. That was great.
There you go. I think one of the things that is so amazing is, and it maybe doesn't happen all that often in life, but it does happen in life where there is this thing that should be so wonderful. And yet there is this black line right through the middle of it that is awful. And I suppose that could be, you know, it's your daughter's wedding, but your ex-husband's being horrible. Or you've got this new job and then you realize there's this terrible coworker you're going to be right next to or whatever it is. But something that kind of slices right through what should otherwise be so wonderful. And I guess that's a little bit akin to what we were talking about earlier when you might have this plethora of wonderful notices or five-star ratings or whatever, and all it takes is something really awful in the middle of it, and especially when you're not prepared for it, when you're expecting it to be one more accolade, one more word of praise, and instead Cameron Lane is sent reeling by this mysterious message. I mean, and it's in a lot of ways, that's of course what the whole heart of this novel is.
Mm-hmm. And I just had a book launch party on last Wednesday, and I read that exact passage, and I was there surrounded by all those same people, all these wonderful supporters, and I just thought, oh, how horrible that would be to look at your phone and get something so nasty in that moment of joy and accomplishment and just bringing you down to the darkness of it all.
Right. What is really interesting about this criticism, the way, you know, you have crafted, those are obviously your words, the way you've crafted this critical email is that this criticism is not irrational nor shallow. I mean, it's based on something substantive. I mean, it's not I hate you, you're a big fat cow or whatever. I mean, you know, in a sense, you could kind of shed that, maybe it might still sting, but this is a case of something, you know, I mean, you're being accused of something really awful, and one can imagine how someone might make that supposition, erroneous though it might be. But I think I wonder how much you thought about the nature of what this criticism should be, because it seems to me that's part of what makes it work so well.
Yeah, thank you. I give a lot of credit to one of my brainstorming partners who's a brilliant writer. She's got a novel coming out in the winter called The Champagne Letters, Kate McIntosh. And it was her idea for it to be more specific. So I was like, you know, what if someone just messaged her? You know, I knew the hatred I wanted coming into her and shaking her up and being like, you're a terrible writer, you're ugly, whatever, right? And she's like, no, I think it should be something really, really, specific that even the reader doesn't necessarily know if it's true or not, right, for part of the novel. So, or did she do it unconsciously? So there's so much doubt to be had with this specific accusation that is made about her.
Hmm.
I think that it works better.
Right. I think another reason all of this works so well is because of the personality of your main character, Cameron Lane. And she is somebody with whom we feel affection. We certainly feel sympathy. We admire her in some respects. And yet, you know, she's far from perfect. And she has just enough kind of frailties and vulnerabilities to make her, you know, even more interesting than she would otherwise be. Tell us a little bit about how you crafted her in terms of personality, strengths and weaknesses, and so on.
Yeah, there's some of me in her 20 years ago, I guess, when I, you know, had this first experience, and I very much relate to how she felt. But Cameron has a very, very messy life, and that was really fun for me because it makes, you know, it adds so many suspects to this online hatred and wonder if it is really personal. So she has an ex-husband and a new wife who can't stand her, or they can't stand each other. She works as a high school guidance counselor, so she has kids who don't like her. She's always intervening in, these messes that these kids get into, and there is a high school mean girl that is, like, terrifying. She's got a much younger boyfriend. She's got, a teenage daughter. So there's so much going on in her life in addition to this dream that she has been pursuing. And, I enjoy Cameron. I think she has a good sense of humor at times. She's a relatable person, even though she tries so hard to fix these problems that she doesn't take advice. And, so I did see a couple of reviews that said her publicist tell her not to engage, and then she does, which is so stupid. And I'm like, well, it'd be a pretty boring book if she just didn't engage.
Right. Absolutely. And I think part of what's really interesting too is that, I mean, at the outset, her assumption is that this is a stranger that she does not know. I mean, she doesn't recognize this name Ingrid Wandry at all, but as the story progresses and as more messages come to her, and we should also mention that other people, for instance, where this negative review is then as initially posted, others sort of seem to climb aboard that same bandwagon. I mean, similarly outraged without really knowing the facts, and so it's in a sense spreads like a virus. She begins, that is, Cameron Lane, begins to suspect that this may not have all started with a stranger. It may have started with someone she thought was her friend, maybe somebody she even loves. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things you did do a really good job of is helping us understand how paranoid one would be. And that, you know, when someone's, you know, talking with you and then they walk away and then what is that strange look on their face? I mean, was that like a trace of a half smile and so on? And we realized that when you have been attacked like this, that is how you start to view the world and everybody in it through this eye, through these eyes of suspicion and so on. Tell us more about how you tried to shape that aspect of this story in terms of the kind of feelings that are just swamping Cameron Lane at every turn.
Well, I think one of the scariest things about this book and, you know, anyone in the public eye at all is the anonymity of the internet. So, you know, again, it literally could be anybody. It could be somebody, you know, I put a book out in the world. I could have a so-called friend who's mad at me for some reason. They could give me a one-star review and I would never know. You know, I could be, it could be anybody in my life who wants to hurt me and I would have no idea. So, you know, sometimes now since I've written this book now, I have looked at, there's an Amazon, there's a one star, there's no review, there's just a one star. And I was like, who did that? You know, it is so interesting to kind of suspect everybody in your orbit. And, you know, originally she does think it's just somebody out in the ether, but as it becomes more personal and builds and grows, she starts to realize that there are so many people who have a reason to want her career to fail. So it's less about necessarily hurting her. It's about destroying what she's building. And, you know, there are people with actual reasons that, you know, their life might be better if she wasn't an author, including, you know, the people in her intimate circle. So,
Right. Yeah,
she... There's a lot of possible suspects.
Right.
Sure,
could this be her jealous best friend? Could this be her jealous boyfriend? Could this be her jealous daughter? Starts to turn kind of everything on its head. And I think that's really an interesting challenge for an author. And I think you meet this challenge so well. That is to line up an array of plausible suspects. And in a sense, they are planted in the course of the story, and I suppose it is an interesting challenge to make each of them seem authentic, realistic. I mean, and not just sort of planted there for artifice, or I mean, for the sake of confusing the reader or misleading the reader. But I also should think that's probably one of the most fun parts of writing a book like this.
Absolutely, yeah. It's really fun to, and it was so easy in this book, you know? Like, so it's fun to create all these other characters who are in her life, and there's some interesting people in her life that have been there, you know, we all have people brought into our lives in various different ways and different histories, and it was very easy to make them suspicious, because, you know, as she gets more paranoid, everyone has a reason. Everyone has, you know, when I published 20 years ago, I had one friend who was not happy for me, like really not happy for me, to the point that we are no longer friends. And it was just so, I think it was, she had wanted to do something like this and I had gone ahead and done it, and she made some, you know, well, I wrote a novel of fiction. It was a humorous novel. And she's like, I feel like I told you personal things and you may have put them in this story. And I was like, well, read it and tell me if I did. And she refused to read it. Like, it was a very weird reaction. But, you know, there's people like that. And so, you know, she does have a lot of very viable suspicion about some of the characters in her life.
Sure. And, of course, jealousy is such a pervasive human emotion, and it can poison a whole lot of relationships, including very close friendships, family ties, and so on. I want to touch very briefly on an interesting subplot, and that is at rather late in the novel, when Cameron Lane has become so desperate to learn the identity of who this is, that she actually hires somebody named Shane Miller, who kind of specializes in trying to identify who has actually sent such and such an email and so on. I mean, the kind of discovery that most of us would have absolutely no hopes of uncovering. I'm just curious, what kind of research you did into that, and are there people out there who really can unlock these kind of questions in terms of who actually sent me this horrible email, for instance, or who posted this awful thing?
Right. So lucky for me, I have a husband who is a CIO. So he's a tech guy with a lot of experience on different aspects of the business. And I asked him that. I'm like, is there someone out there? And he's like, of course there is. Like, if, you know, there are people out there, hackers. I mean, we see the things that happen in the world today. And, you know, I don't know how you would find one in real life, but there are definitely people with that kind of capability. And in the book, this guy, he worked at Google and, you know, security expert, and he knows how to trace all the various, IP addresses and figure out who this is, and add such an element to the story because we're waiting to finally find out who the real culprit is. And then the plot takes another twist.
Right, exactly. And Cameron Lane's encounter with Shane Miller when she actually sits down with him for the first time. And he basically says, in a sense, be careful what you wish for. I mean, whatever I end up uncovering, you know, could blow up your whole life in terms of who this might be. Do you really want to know? And she does really want to know. And, of course, we have to read the novel right to the end in order to figure out who ultimately is behind all of this. It's a wonderfully crafted novel. I really, really enjoyed it start to finish. And it's the kind of novel that gives us a whole lot to think about. The novel is called The Haters. It is published by Grand Central, and the author is Robin Harding. Robin Harding, I really enjoyed your book, and I so enjoyed this opportunity to talk with you about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes with all the future novels that you will be giving the world.
Thank you so much, Greg. I love this chat, and I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be previewing for you the next show at the Racine Theater Guild, the musical First Date. I'll be speaking with its director, Doug Instanis. On Thursday, Kaylin Polamaris is joining us for her monthly visit to the program. With her will be Dr. Jim Schutte, research director of the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. He is a farmer and a crop advisor and a member of the board of directors for the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. We'll talk primarily about something called regenerative farming. And on Friday, I'm excited to speak with bestselling author James Patterson about his newly published biography of one of the greatest athletes in history, golf legend Tiger Woods. Mr. Patterson's book is titled Tiger, Tiger, His Life as It's Never Been Told Before. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archive on our website, wgtd.org. And the podcast version of The Morning Show allows you to hear a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Well, between now and Monday, there is not a drop of precipitation in our weather forecast. Today will be partly sunny and more comfortable than it's been, a high today of 83 degrees, partly cloudy overnight with a low of 65, sunny tomorrow with a high of 78 degrees. Very pleasant conditions expected to continue for the rest of the week and all weekend long. Sunshine and nicely comfortable temperatures. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.